A warning to our listeners, this episode contains references to domestic violence.
I remember going to the bathroom and checking my makeup and wondering what she would think of me.
Hi, I'm Jordan Raskopoulos, and this is About.
And I waltz in and there's that look of recognition.
That look of recognition.
I found that I was really drawn to her for her thinking.
I didn't expect that we would connect that way.
That connection.
We had chatted online a little bit.
Sometimes then you just hit it off instantly and you just know.
When you just hit it off.
And it was just like this amazing night of drinking champagne and chatting and...
And literally it happened like that.
Instantly I just felt at ease and...
I thought that she was losing interest in me and in our conversation because she was spending a lot of time on her phone.
Red flag.
And I said to her, are you okay? And she's like, yeah, I'm just looking at something. And then she's like, would you be interested in me? And I'm like, what do you mean? And she's like...
I just thought I'd like to help you. I'd like to donate for you.
She offered to be our egg donor. She was in fact looking at her calendar, trying to work out when her cycle would finish and when she could start a new one. We always joke it was a bit of love at first sight and it was our one night stand that we had together.
Welcome to the world of domestic surrogacy and egg donation. In Australia, it's actually illegal to get paid to give your eggs away or to have a baby for someone else. So it becomes kind of like dating, finding the right person who you, you know, vibe with, who'll do it with you. For free. Say like Melissa Holman. In her day job, she's a nurse, and this story starts while she was working a shift in her local hospital.
One day I went to work and I heard a crying sound. The bathrooms had a nurse in it and she was hiding in there. And I walked in and she said to me, I've just had my IVF results come back and it's negative again. I just don't know when it's going to happen for me. All I want is to be a mum. You know, I couldn't get it out of my mind. This woman really needed this, wanted this so badly. And she was broken and she was tired and she was angry. And yeah, that stuck in my mind.
In fact, she couldn't get the whole thing out of her mind. She started seeing all these notices in the local paper, women out there desperately looking for other women to donate their eggs. Mel was married, she'd had two kids, easily, and she didn't want any more.
My mum used to always call me the fixer. I was always that kid who was sort of in there, sort of helping, and there was anyone who was struggling or having a hard time or something that was wrong and just wanted to make things right, and I would want to step in and fix it for them.
She started to wonder if this was a situation she could fix. But first, she had to get the all clear.
It was a rainy Tuesday afternoon. We were running through pretty much an almost empty theme park in our little ponchos, and I remember just jumping on a carousel with the girls right as the rain came pouring down and the music was playing in the background. And I remember looking at the kids and they were giggling and shrieking with, you know, the water pouring down around us, and just having a real revel in motherhood moment where I looked at those girls and just felt extremely grateful to be their mother. And even though my youngest at the time was only about 5, I wanted to see what she would think about her mother giving some eggs, and she was very, very just quite simplistic about it in her little way. I said to her, Mum's friend Charlotte, she doesn't have any eggs to be able to make a baby, so she can't have any babies to go on rides with or play with. And my eldest perked up, well, why don't you just give her some of yours then? You just don't see it coming. Like, you don't think that you'll ever do that many. You just start doing one and then babies are born and they have siblings and then there's a few sets of twins in there and it just happens before you know it.
There was Leslie, Robin, Patria. I'm at the moment a living world record holder for amount of children born via...
There was Angela.
Egg donation and surrogacy.
I should clarify that record is unofficial. Please, someone from Guinness, get onto that.
Just so many.
Linda. 17 babies born via egg donation.
Kelly.
Yeah, 18. Well, actually, it's technically 19 because one of them's gestational.
Linda. Mel. Jay.
There was only one of me and so many of them, and the list seemed to get longer and longer, and there was such a huge shortage of egg donors. I couldn't help enough of them quick enough.
So Mel and a couple of friends decided to set up an online meeting place for women who needed eggs and women who wanted to share their eggs. Sort of like Tinder for eggs. They called it Eggda. No, no. Plenty of eggs. Egg Harmony. Ovum Cupid. No, they didn't do any of those. It was called Egg Donation Australia. And soon there were hundreds of women pouring on the site, seeking advice and donors and surrogates, people to have their baby for them. That's when Mel met Teresa Trevor.
We are from completely different worlds. You know, she's like somebody who comes home and spends time with her family, and whereas I was spending a lot of time travelling at that time, working in more of a corporate environment. And I remember thinking, my goodness, there is no way I would ever meet you in any other circumstance. And I love being pregnant. It's just the most beautiful feeling, and I love everything about it. It's just that my body doesn't love it. Oh, I tried to have a child since I was 30 and I had quite a few miscarriages. I had a conversation with the fertility specialist, and she showed me a graph. I call it a graph of diminishing returns. So I had a look at it, and here I was at the end of the graph.
Teresa was living in Hong Kong at the time, and the experts had told her that she'd need donated eggs. She started getting to know Mel and other women online. Then she got some unexpected news. She and her husband had fallen pregnant without help, with twins.
It's like being offered your dream, at the same time knowing full well that it's probably going to be taken away from you. Melissa was there through the whole time. She'd text me every day. We'd talk every day. So somebody who has basically been my main support person was someone who I'd never met in real life. She'd ask me about my scans. She'd want to know when I was going into the clinic. And on one particularly sad day, when all the vital signs of the pregnancy were looking very tragic, she just said to me, you know, if you can't have these babies, I'll have a baby for you. I didn't want to need her help. I just wanted these children inside me to come to life. So I actually said something to her. I was like, oh, it's okay. I don't need your help. I'm going to be fine. I'm going to have these children. You hope against hope and don't even allow the pessimism to come in, because you think if I just remain positive, then maybe it can all come true. But of course, that's not reality. And so I came home to Australia from Hong Kong to have the procedure to remove the dead embryos from my body. And actually going and meeting Mel face-to-face, which up until that point I'd never actually met her face-to-face. I actually went and met her, and then I had a strange feeling in my body, and I said, I think I need to go to the hospital. And Mel came along to that appointment with me, and it turned out that I had a 15-centimetre blood clot in my hip. Obviously then I had to go and see a haematologist, and we both saw his face when we talked about the fact that I had just been pregnant and I was considering trying to be pregnant again. And he looked at me very gravely and he said, under no circumstances can you get pregnant again. You've got to stop doing this. You're going to kill yourself. So instead of falling down through the centre of the earth into some sort of depression, I fell into this beautiful warm embrace of a safety net in Mel, who said, it's okay, we're going to get this done. I'll carry a baby for you. What's next? Actually, it was traditional surrogacy, so that actually means that it was her egg in her body. I realised through this whole process that the legislation was out of date. It made me really cranky, actually. If I go into a clinic and ask to do IVF treatment for surrogacy, it's going to cost $17,000 to $20,000. And if Mel goes into a clinic and says that she's going to have a pregnancy with her husband through IVF, it's going to cost $5,000 to $7,000. So it seems incredibly unfair that the people who are the most disadvantaged for infertility, the women who were born without a uterus, or the women who have had a hysterectomy, or they've had endometriosis so bad that they've said, you're going to have to take that uterus out. Or like me. So those are the women who don't get any Medicare rebate simply because the act is not up to date. So Mel went into the IVF clinic and said that she wanted to have a baby with her husband. And they said, oh, her husband doesn't want to go into the little room and do his business into a cup because he feels embarrassed about doing it in the clinic. They said, oh, never mind. Well, he can just do it at home and you just bring it in. So instead of her husband doing it, my husband did it and we just brought it in. And then she had a baby with my husband instead of hers. So this swap that took, you know, a few minutes saved about $12,000. So it was pretty substantial when we'd already had three miscarriages and we still had a whole pregnancy ahead of us in terms of cost. As opposed to feeling like a rebellion, it felt like my right. That's how things should be, that I shouldn't be disadvantaged simply because I can't have a child myself. For me, doing the sperm swap was just, well, I'm just going to be on level playing field with ordinary women.
The next part of Mel's story could upset some listeners. You're going to hear from Sarah Cutts. Sarah is an egg donor too. Mel was there for Sarah when she started learning about it all. It's how they became best friends. And Sarah thought she knew everything about Mel. One night, Sarah gets a call.
Mel called me and she was crying. Couldn't quite understand what she was saying. She was absolutely distraught. And she had said that there had been a big fight and that she was really actually terrified for her life and could she come and stay the night. About 2 a.m., Mel rocks up in her pyjamas on my doorstep with two little girls, half asleep in their pyjamas and slippers and just carrying basically the bare minimum of whatever they could just grab and get out of there with at the time. We, you know, put the girls to bed and we went and sat outside with a coffee and she showed me this scar on her face and she said, you know, he'd done that a year previously. He'd punched her and her teeth had gone through her lip. I was so shocked. I couldn't believe that she could hide it like that. Because it kind of was like everything was perfect.
At that stage, it had been 12 years of violence and it was our normal. At times there's been past stigmas of women who are victims of domestic violence as being stupid or low socioeconomic. And I was neither of those things. I was, you know, employed, I was educated. And, you know, I tried to sort of just get through it the best we could and try and minimise the damage. And ultimately that fixer girl came right back in trying to, I guess, just trying to fix things. That it made me, if I, you know, somehow said something that he would possibly understand, that he would realise what he had in his, you know, partner and children, that he would somehow change his way. And I felt sorry for him. You know, he'd always had said that he had had a rough childhood. I felt that I was in some aspects the stronger one, even though I was the weaker one. There was a moment that things really hit home one day where I was working in a vascular and neuro ward and I cared for a woman and she was quite young and she sustained quite a serious head injury because of a punch from a partner and we had to feed her and change her pad and shower her and, you know, move her. And she had a little boy at home, I remember that, and now she was having to go through severe rehab just to be able to feed herself and because someone had punched her. And I remember looking at her going, that could be me. If I didn't do something, that I probably would end up like that one day. I think sometimes when your whole world is falling down, it's much easier to focus your energy elsewhere. A lot of donors describe donating and being surrogates as somewhat addictive. It's because there's something quite satisfying that you really love about watching people have their ultimate dream come true. To a certain extent, it became, like I said, a pursuit of other people's happiness where I would focus my energy outbound rather than dwelling on my own pain and misery.
While Mel was pregnant with my child, her relationship was deteriorating, absolutely deteriorating. And on one hand, I felt a great sense of caretaker role because looking after her was looking after my baby, but also worry about her situation because she was spiraling really into a quite a chaotic space.
I remember one night while I was out driving, there was a car behind me.
Someone's tailing her on the freeway. And
I thought maybe they were just impatient and maybe they just wanted to get past, so I pulled over to let them pass. And they tried to run me off the road.
Like kind of tried to come onto the side of her car and push the car over to the edge of the freeway.
And I freaked out, not knowing who this person was, and kept driving, and they followed me. And I rang 000, screeching at them to get the police while he tried to hit my car. And I didn't know who it was. I wasn't sure if it was just some unlucky random person. And a 000 operator told me to go to the nearest petrol station so I would be on the CCTV cameras.
And so she rang me when she was there, and obviously she was in incredibly emotional state, and the car just circled around and around and around her, and it was intimidating her. And we to this day, we don't actually know who that person was. Someone's doing something so incredible for you. You kind of hope that their life gives them something beautiful. At that time, instead, she just had to go through hell.
You've got somebody who's threatening you all the time, and you just can't rest. You're sleeping with one eye open, essentially. It was really hard to pretend some days. Some days it just felt numb, and some days I didn't really want to eat. I was just traumatized. But when you're carrying a baby, it's lunchtime. It's time to eat something. You're looking after a baby now. I think the explanation to why I would take on something as big as pregnancy at a time of my life that was so hard was both complex and simple at the same time. And I spoke to Teresa and just said, this is really, really hard, but I really want to do this. And this is something that I committed to, and I loved her. She's my dear friend, and this was her dream. And I knew that she would be there and she'd support me. You know, whatever I needed to do, she'd be there.
So I was Mel's birth partner. It's Sarah again. It was actually one of the most amazing things I've ever witnessed. Mel was induced and they hooked up the gas the last 20 minutes of her labour. And I just remember standing there and just watching Teresa's face and just remember looking at her, and she was just like in awe and disbelief.
I got to see the head crowning, and then she came out screaming and squirming, and was placed immediately on Mel's belly, and I held her there. We waited until the umbilical cord stopped pulsing and I cut it.
And she just sat there, you know, for like 20 minutes, just staring at this baby, and it was like nothing else existed but her and this baby in the world. It was the moment that someone else becomes a mum for the first time.
And we were just there snuggling in, and I could not believe that this was my world and this was happening to me, and here I was with my dream in my arms. My baby was 6 months old, and everything gets transferred over, and I become officially the mother instead of unofficially. I can go and get passports and all those things. So it's a really important step.
I found out unexpectedly that because I was still legally married to him, even though we'd been separated prior to the conception, he was still deemed the father on the birth certificate.
And there's just a few administrative things that need to be done that are pretty much like tick box and standards. So he actually sent me a text message saying that he wasn't going to sign it. And it was just devastating for me, realizing that he was going to be a cog in the wheel in this situation and not going to provide the material that was needed for me to become truly my child's mother in the eyes of the law.
You know, I was used to him hurting me. That was, you know, a pretty common thing, but he wasn't just hurting me, but he was hurting somebody that I loved, you know, and he was hurting her to hurt me. And that was when I decided enough was enough and it was just time to fight back.
And I thought, you know what? I am totally going to call your bluff on this.
Yeah, Teresa got right on him in her fiery way and she said,
Now listen here, I've got a teething child. She is screaming. So if you want to be the dad, I'm going to bring her around. I'm going to leave her on the doorstep. I've got nappies here, you can have them. And while you are looking after this child and doing your dad duties, I'm going to go down to the local lawyer. I'm going to get all the information I need to apply for child support. And then you can start paying it. It's absolutely, of course, not at all what I wanted. But I knew that it would scare him. And it totally did.
We dealt with it beautifully, I think. Like we got through it in a way that gave Teresa her baby. And at least that fight was over.
It was an incredible thing to witness how the legal system can be used against a person who genuinely does need protection from the Medicare system so that I could have a child, and yet it was completely not there for me. And then I watched it with Mel, how the law was being used against her as a weapon against her. I spent days editing work that she had created so that I could give it to the lawyers through every piece of abuse that she had experienced at his hands. So then I graphically understood the sort of situations that she had been in.
I think it was at the stage where it was kind of like kill or be killed, really.
And there was multiple days in court.
So that went on for months. It was months like that.
A lot of my other friends, they were there without fail, with me, beside me, when I had to go and face hard days.
She's my other half, I guess, in a lot of ways.
It's her and I against the world.
I really felt like I'd found my sisterhood or my tribe or people who care about your happiness as much as you care about theirs.
Now these days, Mel is almost like a completely different person.
Mel lives in Queensland with her children. She's now studying to become a midwife.
Instead of calling me, you know, at 11:30 at night crying, you know, she's in bed, snuggled up to the man she loves.
She's met someone. She's going to marry him. And 3 weeks ago, she gave birth to a baby. As a surrogate. For yet another woman. Come on, Guinness. And the sisterhood is always there, no matter how complicated life gets.
My marriage had really seriously deteriorated. I just decided I need to get out of this situation and go somewhere where I can think and be loved. The first place that I thought of was to go and spend time with Mel. I basically just moved into her house for a little while, and my child was really going through a bit of a time where she had to be carried all the time. And I remember putting her into the carrier so that Mel could hold her. I thought, oh, maybe she would just be more comfortable with Mel because Mel birthed her, and, you know, the whole familiar smell and all the things that they talk about, bonding. But she still looked at me and said, Mama, Mama. She puts up her arms and everything is right with the world.
If you want to find out more about the murky legal swamp that is surrogacy in Australia, Radio National has stuck on the proverbial snorkel and jumped in. You've just heard how Teresa thinks that surrogacy law in Australia is broken, and it turns out she's not the only one. It's meant to be altruistic, but it kinda, sorta, sometimes isn't exactly. Reporter Hagar Cohen has that story on Background Briefing. We also have a comic strip on surrogacy on the RN website. Our show is there too. Can I ask one more thing? Please review our show on iTunes. It helps us to help you. Or possibly just helps us. Either way, please review us. This episode was mixed by Russell Stapleton. Thanks also to Tim Roxburgh for editorial ears. If anything has come up for you in this episode, please call Lifeline on 13 11 14. This Is About is produced by Belinda Lopez, Jesse Cox, and now, Jess Bennett. Half of our team now basically have the same name. We're very confused, but delighted. I'm Jesse Raskopoulos.